Log Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Walter Dean for the show called Getting It Done. Today's show, we will feature a famous black lawyer. No, it's not Thurgood Marshall, but it's Johnny Cochran, who most people believe he became famous for O.J. Simpson and the O.J. Simpson trial. However, we're going to find out a little different. So let's give a listen to Charlie Ross, or Charlie Rose.
Television in New York City. This is Charlie Rose.
The O.J. Simpson trial riveted the nation and divided it along racial lines in many cases. At the center of the controversy stood defense attorney Johnny Cochran. The trial lawyer and former prosecutor has made a career out of attacking police misconduct and defending and suing people on that issue. No stranger to the spotlight, his high-profile clients include Michael Jackson and Jim Brown. Journey to Justice is his rise to the helm of Simpson's so-called dream team and the climb that preceded it, and I'm very pleased to have him on this broadcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much, John.
Great to have you here. Shreveport, Charity Hospital. How many years ago? About 50 years ago?
Well, a little more than that. Maybe 59 years ago.
59? Your dad was Johnny Cochran Sr.
That's right.
He lives with you now in Los Angeles. He's seeing this sort of evolution.
He does. And he's a great inspiration to me.
Tell me about growing up in Louisiana before you moved to Los Angeles.
I have the greatest memories of it. A family of so much love. I knew nothing about segregation, knew nothing about prejudice or any kind of racial dilemmas or whatever. Just a time of love and family, being together. You just could be whatever you wanted to be. And I remember early on my parents stressing education. The need for education being the key. It was just great. I remember the Sundays we sat down, we ate together, we walked, you know, to church every Sunday. It was a great, great time.
How many brothers and sisters?
I had at that time two sisters. I have two sisters and one brother.
Yeah. And they, where are they?
Are they all in Los Angeles? We all stayed there.
We all come when the family moved to LA, all stayed there.
Yeah, we all stayed there and we've always done that.
Your mother was Hattie?
Hattie Cochran.
Yeah. She was deceased.
This died in October of 1991, almost 5 years now.
Yeah. So she saw Johnny become the lawyer that he wanted to be.
Well, yes, she did. And I feel she's still very much with me now. You know, on all the days, I think about it.
Religion is important. I mean, it's part of you deep inside.
Very much part of me. It guides everything I do. I believe very strongly that in all that ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct that path.
You moved to L.A., and your dad by then, what, was it insurance?
Yes, he was in the Golden State Mutual Life Insurance Company. Yeah. Yes.
You went to L.A. High.
I did.
I loved it. It's a great school.
Great school.
Dustin Hoffman, a friend.
One of my classmates, yes. It was an exciting time for me.
When did you say lawyer in the legal system, prosecutor, defense attorney, judge?
Well, I actually started that, the thought, in junior high school. Remember the conversation with my parents? My mother wanted me to be a doctor. My father said, well, you know, if he wants to be a lawyer, let him be there. But she said, then promise me you'll be the best you can be. From that moment on, I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I have kept that dream alive, actually. And so by the time I got to high school, it was great because I was in a great area where I could compete with kids. And from that point on, it's been what I wanted to do.
If you're a young black man growing up in Los Angeles or growing up anywhere in America in the 50s, people like Thurgood Marshall, giants, I mean, nobody stood taller than Thurgood Marshall when he argued Brown versus Board of Education.
Absolutely. He became my absolute legal mentor. I mean, what he did in Brown versus the Board of Education was remarkable. And I thought, gee, I could do this and try to change society and change it for the better. I thought it was remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Went to law school where?
In Los Angeles, Loyola Law School in Los Angeles.
There's a story that you wanted to go to Harvard. Dad said, I got some other kids to educate beside you.
He did. And my sisters, especially at that time, and yes. And so I understood. I had that dream. But I went on and went to UCLA undergrad and went out to Loyola Law School.
City attorney?
Yes. A young prosecutor, started off. Did those 2.5 years. It was exciting.
Yeah. And then went out to private practice?
Yeah, went to private practice after about 2.5 years there in the city attorney's office. And I was in private practice for almost 11 years.
Where did this sense of involvement with police misconduct, which has shaped your life, becomes central.
It really stemmed from the time in the city attorney's office. In California, Charlie, we have something called 148 of the Penal Code, which is a charge that's resisting, interfering, delaying, obstructing an officer in the performance of his duty. As a young prosecutor, I'd see these defendants come in, and many times they still showed the effects of injuries they'd suffered. And invariably, they were charged with the offense involving the officer. The officer, seeing no problem, no worse than aware, no bruises at all. But yet, we were prosecuting these guys for misdemeanor charges. And after a period of time, it became very emotional for everyone. Most of these people were African Americans. Many times, the police officers were white. So, over a period of time, it came to me the same that, gee, we're doing this to keep these defendants from suing the city of Los Angeles. To me, that was part of a conspiracy there. And the reports all said the same. This person was resisting and interfering. And we have a saying that these are gentlemen are people who had flunked the attitude test. Because, you know, mere words can be resisting and interfering.
Cop pulls them over. Their attitude is not just right. Something happens.
It escalates and they end up getting assaulted.
Why do you think that happens?
I think it has to do with race and racism. You know, whether we like it or not, racism has played a part in our lives in this country. We all love this country. It's the greatest country in the world. But it doesn't help to pretend that we don't have some problems. They've gotten better, but we have to keep working at it. And I saw that pretty clearly. I thought it was an issue of us.
And it comes from just the life that the community that people are living in. It comes from wherever racism flows out.
Oh, I think so. It has a lot to do with the history of the Los Angeles Police Department. We talk about that in Journey to Justice. Many of these police officers were recruited by Chief Parker, very strong chief,
William Parker,
a legend in his time. He really was.
Jack Webb made him
very famous. He went to the Southern States to recruit tough people from the South who came there. And they were almost like an occupying force. We didn't have community-based police. These police officers lived many of them outside the city of L.A. They'd come in and, patrol and supposedly protect and serve in areas they never lived in. It made a difference. They didn't know these people. They came with all the biases and stereotypical thinking. And it was a real problem. And, what I saw starting there as a young prosecutor in 63 to about 65, of course, culminated in August of 1965. What was known as the Watts riots. You could really see it coming. There were so many of these cases. And always, the trigger was always a police officer stops a citizen and always escalates. That was the problem.
But Los Angeles has also had a very popular black mayor who had been a policeman.
He really was. But think about it. Tom Brady was wonderful. He meant so much to our city. You see the skyline today. He's one of my mentors also. But he was a police officer. It was so bad and so tough on him, as bright as he was. He could only go to the rank of lieutenant. So what did he do? He left the department, they became a lawyer, he ran for the city council, and ultimately became mayor. So he was over the chief. But the chief was very strong. Parker was gone by now. But Parker's driver, the successor of chiefs, Reagan, Davis, and some others, was now Daryl Gates, who had learned at the foot of
Bill Parker. Bill Parker.
Yes.
Yeah. Jerome Pratt.
Yes. Yes.
What did that mean?
That case taught me a lot of things, Charlie. It taught me, among other things, to never accept the official version at face value. This is an innocent man, convicted of a murder that he didn't commit. He's a man who is a victim of the FBI's counterintelligence program. As a naive young lawyer in 1972, I won 10 murder cases in a row. I didn't think that I was going to lose. I thought this was another case. The prosecutor on the other side was in my law school class at Loyola. I thought I could trust these people. This was going to be fair, a fair fight. I didn't know that he was a target or a victim of the counterintelligence program. They really used perjured testimony. A key witness was asked, are you an informant? Have you ever been an informant for the FBI or any other agency? He said, no. The prosecutor knew that he had been an informant. In fact, at that time, through the records we found out afterwards, he informed 33 times for the FBI. Now, of course, we know he's an informant for the LA County DA's office, the LA Police Department, and the FBI. Yet they continue to stonewall a man who's been in jail from 72 until now. Actually, he was in jail since 1970. So 26 years for a crime he didn't commit. And I've said that one case will not let me retire from practice until he's free.
I don't understand. Whatever the city is, how good cops allow bad cops to do this? Do they sit by? Do they know? Is the system so built
so that if, in fact, you try to stop it, you're consumed by that. It's a very tough issue. It's a real tough issue. Just listen, here in New York, you've got a situation where a police officer is involved with the death of a young man, where the judge acquitted the police officer that caused the furor. One of the people who testified against that police officer has had to be transferred because of harassment and fear for her safety. There is really this kind of thin line, a real siege mentality, which is us against them. Now, police officer, police work is very tough, Charlie.
You can put your life on the line.
Every day.
And too many mayors have been to too many funerals of too many good cops.
So they tend to stick together. That's how a Mark Furman could exist for 20 years. People knew about him. Nobody calls him on. That's how he flourishes. And so he gets to retirement day in this kind of situation. And he's not all the police. Now, make no mistake about it. There are a number of good police, but they tend to look the other way. Good guy, bad guy. The good guy doesn't say anything about it. Bad guy goes on and does what he has to do.
Back to your career. You're driving down the highway with your family. You're in your brown Rolls Royce. You are known, prosecuted, successful, admired. You're pulled over. What happened?
I'm the assistant district attorney for Los Angeles County. It's 1978, 1979. I'm doing what I love doing. I've gone back from private practice now. I hear the officers give commands. Get out of the car and put your hands over your head. I get out of the car and I look back, and it's amazing. There are police cars.
Not one, but three.
Oh, there's three police cars. There's officers behind doors barricaded. Their guns are out there pointed toward me. Now, I know from my experience, you never do your fighting or arguing in the street. I'm going to step over the curb. I'm concerned because my children, my two youngest children in the car, they start to cry when they see this happening to their dad. Officer walks with his gun in hand, and I say to him, put that gun away. My children are in that car. So the children see this gun. He comes inside. I carry a bag. The officer goes inside the bag, opens my bag.
He has a wallet and stuff.
There's no problem because of this, but he goes inside this bag, and he sees my badge. And then he's waving off and everything. He has a badge in his hand. Assistant DA, number three. I said, no, get your sergeant out here. We're going to talk about why this happened. They give me an excuse that, gee, you know, we thought this car might be stolen in this area. I said, wait a minute, see those license plates there? JCJR? They've been with this car for as long as I've had it.
I've read your car before.
I said, you know, you stopped me because I was an African American. That's not right. You had no reason. Well, you know, that's not it. No, they didn't admit it. But that was clearly the reason. We're going 30 miles an hour. It was a Saturday afternoon, a bright, sunny day on Sunset Boulevard. I'll never forget that because I then was faced with the situation, Charlie, trying to explain to my daughter, Tiffany, who's now a newscaster.
Florida, South Carolina, still?
Yes, absolutely. Why? Her daddy was stopped. She said to me, Daddy, aren't you on the same side of the police? I said, yes, honey, I am. And I remember how we were isolated by our folks. I did the best I could to understand that there were good police officers, make her understand. There were good police officers, bad police officers, and sometimes people did things. It was difficult.
As a prosecutor, do you ever put a policeman on the stand who you knew might not be retelling the story exactly the way it happened in order to get a conviction?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's one of the things. And, you know,
didn't that bother you? I mean, there's a defendant there you're convicting, perhaps.
Troubled me no end. In fact, the reports are written so well. They all said the same thing. You know? When they're just drunk driving arrest.
So you were part of the same system. You were putting guys on, you know, is close to perjury.
Exactly.
So you...
Exactly. So what I did?
What?
I went to my superiors, and I said, we talked about this in the book, in a chapter called A Soul Divided.
Right.
And I said, I'm not going to prosecute these cases anymore, especially 148s, where I believe the police officers are fabricating these stories. So I become part of the conspiracy to keep these people from suing the city of Los Angeles. And that's what I said to prosecutors. The job doesn't mean anything if you don't try to stand for something. So I stopped doing that, and they respected that.
What do you think will change it?
Well, I think we've got to have good people in the system, people who, it's not just a job. We've got to have police officers who live and work in the community.
Do you believe that the L.A. Police Department that stopped you in your Rolls Royce that day in front of your children are any different than the police department in Los Angeles today?
Oh, I think it's a little better today. I think since we have Chief Woody Williams, I have my differences with some of the
things. Chief Woody Williams was there when O.J. Simpson.
Yes, I have my differences about some of the things he's done, but I think that the attitude is probably a little bit better now than it was at that time. In those days, we had Chief Gates, the incarnation of Parker, in some regard. And although Bill Gates was a very engaging and charming fellow, he had many of those same policies, and he made so many unfortunate public pronouncements.
Other than religion
race, nothing has influenced you more than the battle against what you characterize as police misconduct.
Yes.
Nothing.
Yes.
That's been a real battle all of my life. Because you know what, Jeremy? I realized early on that that first traffic ticket that I tracked, the police officer in the street is the single most powerful figure in the criminal justice system. He can take your life. He can abuse you. He can maim you. And they always think I'll take his word.
There's one problem with this, though, because when you say it, not you, but when anybody says it, and it's so central, it is the fact of so many good, hardworking policemen and women who get up every morning in a job that they don't make that much money and risk their life for our safety, you know, and they're tarred, really, is it, with this sense of you guys are on the take, you guys are corrupt, you guys beat up on minorities.
It's a real problem. One thing about the LAPD, we don't.
It's unfair to them.
It is unfair to them. They have good officers, and most of them are good officers. Here's the problem with it. First of all, in LA, we don't have many officers on the take. We don't have much corruption. What we do have, however, is more brutality than we should. There's a hardcore group of officers, and they now know. They were identified in the Christopher Commission report and the Webster report. These hardcore officers who keep having complaints, keep beating up people. The problem with the good officers, and certainly are many more of them, is they shouldn't stand idly by. These are paramilitary organizations. If the head of the department says
paramilitary organization,
yes, and they follow orders. I mean,
you mean in terms of the whole police department?
The structure, right. These officers follow orders. If the chief says, we're not going to tolerate an officer abusing someone, and if you are there and you see this and you countenance this, you're going to be in trouble also. And the internal affairs really meant what it's supposed to be internal affairs, so they had some teeth in it. But they weren't worried about things like conduct on becoming an officer, where you go out and you accidentally pick up somebody who's a drag queen or something, you get fired for that. But go out and beat somebody up or shoot somebody, whatever, it's real, it's a different story. So you need the good officers to stand up and to speak out. That's what clears the house. And you cannot then, you should be subjected to harassment from the top, from Serpico to this lady here in New York. You're the whistle on this particular officer. You've got to have officers who stand up.
When you got the call, when you heard that O.J. Simpson had been a murderer and O.J. Simpson was being questioned, did you first think what?
What did you think?
I just, my heart went out. I knew O.J. Simpson.
Really?
Quentin's
friend. That's somebody I didn't see very often, but I'd seen before, 2 years before. I'd seen him at a, his daughter had graduated, and I was back at the graduation, went to a party, had a party along with him. I talk about this in the book. Somebody that I had respect for growing up in around Los Angeles. I felt my heart went out. His ex-wife, thought about those children, but I didn't think much else about it except
your first instinct, O.J. Simpson, could not kill someone?
Oh, that was my sense. That was always my sense. I didn't think of him as a suspect at all. I felt so terrible for the children and, you know, for him on the loss. That was my initial thoughts. Right?
Did you know anything about all these other incidents involving him that had come to light during the trial and leading up to the trial and during the trial?
No, I didn't.
It was not part of your knowledge?
No,
not
it wasn't part of my knowledge. No, it wasn't any common knowledge. There may have been an article regarding the January 1st, 1989
right.
incident, but I don't recall that at the time, no.
Jeffrey Toobin, as you know, in his book. Have you read these books, these other books?
I was reading my own.
I know.
I did not, but it's been, I know much of what's said because I'm asked questions all the time.
I know. And the question that everybody asking of the Toobin book is one of them, and each of these books have a flashpoint point in which the question about you is, did you say to anybody at any time, before you took the case,
he's guilty?
Absolutely not. And not once, not anybody. Anybody who stepped forward to say, Cochran said that is a lie.
That's exactly correct. You won't find anybody who stepped forward.
Why would Toobin write?
You know, it's amazing why Jeffrey does things like this. I know Jeffrey Toobin from court. Let me answer this.
He's a distinguished reporter.
He is a distinguished reporter. But he never heard me say it. I've talked to him many, many occasions. He says he has a source and somebody told him, let me tell you why it's a lie. Jeffrey Toobin says that on June 17th, I told somebody that O.J. Simpson's in denial, should go along, and then maybe he should plead to a lesser charge or diminished capacity. On June 17th, I was working as a commentator. And I was going on. I was speaking that evening. I was engaged to go on my life.
Right.
I didn't know anything really about the case. I didn't have any reports. O.J. Simpson had never even called me. He says also that I had inside information. I didn't know anything. I first saw police reports in this case after I entered in the July 22nd of 1994.
I didn't know anything.
I didn't know anything. O.J. Simpson had called me from jail. and to keep the press from making a big hubbub, I never went down to the jail. We talked over the phone.
You would think.
Me and Simpson. And then I talked also with Shapiro. Never went to the jail because I knew if I went down there, it would cause all these limits. Never saw any reports until after I appeared in court on Friday, July 22nd.
So you absolutely, while you were sitting around the Nightline studio waiting to go on Nightline, you didn't say to anybody anything that could have been misinterpreted as he's guilty and he ought to do this or he ought to do that.
Absolutely not.
I know advice for whoever the attorney might be.
I didn't know what the facts were. I didn't know. No, I didn't do that. I was there just to answer questions and to respond. And in fact, that evening, I was concerned that I thought he was going to kill himself that evening. Until it was resolved later. Because that suicide note. There was a suicide note that they read earlier in the day, Kardashian and I think Shapiro, indicating that he said he was innocent, but he just couldn't understand why this was happening to him. It seems though that this so called boat speed chase just seemed like a horrible thing. So again, I was thinking that something bad might happen to
this. This is a guy with amazing strength, isn't it? I mean, you do what he did with his life to become a football star, he did, to succumb to suicide.
It would be hard to understand, but he'd never been through this before. He was a man whose life had really been charmed.
And they had a lot to lose.
You think it was he was having a tough time. But that note was just based upon the note. I had no inside information.
How do you explain Kardashian?
Well, you know, I haven't seen the book yet. I saw only a tease on a program coming up later.
You know,
something about having doubts or whatever.
Right.
I'm surprised. We always thought of him as a very, very, very strong friend for O.J. Simpson.
That's always there every day.
And he never said he renewed his bar license and a lawyer. And renewed his license. I'm really surprised. He never talked about having any doubts before this. And what I'm really surprised about, because by and large, this is a fellow that I have a great respect for, is the ethical violation. He is a lawyer. He cannot.
He's violating the confidentiality of the relationship with the client to be staying there, even now after
absolutely.
The acquittal.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely, because the client has the client right. Released him from doing this. And he now puts himself in a position where the client is about to start a civil trial. Is Kardashian now going to be called as a witness or whatever?
I have doubts about that. I mean, he may even say more than that. I don't know.
Yeah, we haven't seen him. But that thing is so hard to understand. So
he is saying that he could be held in contempt.
Can he even help? Not to stay barred, can do more than that.
Is he violating?
Yes, the attorney-client privilege. That's how serious it is. We're going to do that.
I'm not as familiar with this case as most reporters have covered because it was not my beat. It's not what I do, as you well know. What was in that bag? And whatever happened to that bag?
Which bag are you talking about?
The one that supposedly Kardashian had.
Well, the bag that Kardashian had, and we talk about this in the book. Well, the bag, the ultimate, we brought that bag to court. The bag I think they talked about remained in Kardashian's garage. The police never came back. We then arranged to have that bag picked up and brought to court. And they inspected that bag and went to, I'm sure, every possible lab. There was nothing in that bag. It was the bag that he had. So he had himself a lot of speculation toward him based upon the bag. But the bag had nothing to do with clothes.
Talk about some of the personnel in this case that you've been through this routine before, too.
Yeah.
Shapiro.
Shapiro did a good job in putting together the team. Something happened to him along the way.
Did passing the baton to you bother him?
Yes, that was the triggering mechanism because it wasn't a voluntary passing. It was January 2nd of 1995. O.J. Simpson said, I'm making a change. I want somebody else to head this team up. I need a trial lawyer. At the time, I didn't know. That was difficult for Bob. He offered to leave the team. Simpson was smart. Simpson said, look, I don't want him off this team. You know, call me more problems outside. So he stayed. And he was a team player. And he, at that point, he stayed there. We didn't know how deeply the feelings went. And, you know,
deeply the feelings went that Simpson was guilty.
No, I mean, by deeply the feelings went about this change. I mean, that's why.
Oh, I see how much
he did. But there was resentment, much more resentment than I realized at the time.
You think he believed Simpson? You suggest he believed Simpson was guilty.
You know, early on, he never talked about that. Later on, we have these theories. He came up with this theory about that. Well, I got it. He went over there to key her car.
And that was slash her tires.
Whatever. She didn't kill with the key. What are you talking about? Well, key her car, slash her tires. And so we had these things. And I'd say, look, that's silly. The client has always maintained his innocence. So we had those kind of things. We started one meeting once when he was still in charge about how many here feel that O.J. Simpson is guilty? But take away for it.
All of you sitting around the table, dream team.
Somebody,
he says that, or you say, oh,
he says that.
Start the meeting.
Right. We're guests, you know. And all of us feel very strongly. The client is innocent. And he said, Barry Schick, a pew refill. We're sitting around the table. We can believe it. So those kind of things happen. And there are other things you talk about. He put together some great witnesses. And then Henry Lee, Michael Batten, people like that. The fact that Barry Schick and his fellow on the team, day he cross-examined Van Atter. He comes to court wearing one of those LAPD kind of blue ribbons.
Yeah.
Van Atter is angry at him. Simpson is angry at him. We don't understand what he's doing. He makes friends, goes out of his way to make friends with Tritolaw, who is then the lawyer firm. And I said to him, I said, Bob, when this is over, you're going to be the one sued. And sure enough, he was sued for $50 million by then. One of us were, because we never said to Jeffrey Toobin in the New Yorker magazine about planning
about race.
Yeah. So he goes on.
Planning about claims conduct and about Furman.
And some of the earlier things, but probably the worst
one. The point is that Furman, that it was Shapiro that gave Toobin the first idea to go look up.
Absolutely. And before I ever got on the case, Shapiro had this interview with Toobin and gave him the idea. And he was very proud of that this theory that this race
was. He thought he was thinning the story.
Yeah, but he was very proud of his ability to spin stories. And perhaps the thing that I found most offensive was the fact that one day in the lockup, he was taping, surreptitiously taping our conversations. And I'm saying others may have done that. Can you imagine that?
In order to write a book.
Write a book. And then trying to represent the client. People are working on their book, taping conversations. You make. It's pretty frightening. I don't know where the idea of advocacy comes in and where these lawyers got so lost along the way. And I really found it offensive.
Chris Darden, come back to Shapiro. Chris Darden was here, talked about this, what happened to the relationship between the two of you. Said, among other things, you ran that courtroom. And Coughlin had everybody under his spell. And you were, including the judge.
That's preposterous. We heard some of those comments. We went back and looked at the rules. Judge Beal ruled for the prosecution more than 70% of the time. I have a lot of respect for Judge Beal, but keep in mind, this is the judge who allowed a dream man, kind of a dream man. He admitted that was wrong. He took 60-some plus incidents of right from it and gave us two. One of you couldn't hear.
But what about the civil judge who I think, and again, I plead not following this as closely because I do other things other than cover this trial, other than pay attention to this trial. Has the civil judge said to attorneys, we will not allow evidence of police misconduct unless you have the evidence to back it up? You can't.
There's an invitation.
That's a very dramatic difference. So the central point you hung your defense on, this civil suit will not hear that kind of testimony.
But not exactly. First of all, the lawyer, Bob Baker, is an excellent lawyer. Well, he said you've got to have some
central lawyer.
Yeah, Bob Baker. He's an excellent civil lawyer. Watch him. Remember that name. He's the best lawyer in that courtroom now. Him, Bob Lazen, and you're going to see and hear more about him. What he said is essentially we've got to bring some hard evidence of a police conspiracy or whatever.
Right.
Now, we've been talking already. It's very hard. And the police officer's not going to come forward. The police officer didn't come forward, Alferman. We found that tape through the screenwriter. It's very difficult. So the judge cannot stop, however, the fact that you bring up circumstantial evidence of certain things that happened, I think. And so this judge has taken a tougher view. One of the real problems of it.
It would have made your case much more difficult if you had this kind of ruling in your criminal case.
Well, perhaps so, but look, we wanted to go into bond.
Yeah,
well, let me tell you what Judge Evo curtailed us from talking about being a possible drug killing. They said, you can't bring that up.
Isn't that the right ruling in the case?
I think.
But can a criminal defense attorney bring up any possible scenario?
No, but
unless you have direct evidence that it's.
We need witnesses, and we thought we had witnesses, and they would not allow us to call them. And I think you're going to find, so what we're going to is, by the time this case goes to trial, the civil case, I think you're going to find that the defense will have, they can produce enough witnesses to indicate and be able to argue that there was, this evidence was tampered with. There are certain items that you cannot otherwise explain. There's going to be, no matter what this judge rules,
it's mainly the blood evidence.
It's
going to
be 1.5, right, cc's of missing blood.
Here's what a lot of people ask, and again, I don't want to sound like I'm being tough on the thing because I don't really know that much about it.
A lot of people say it's one thing if there's missing blood. It's another thing to show what happened to it and it was tampered. Oh, absolutely. But they're two very different propositions. That's true. But look, Chuck, if you find EDTA, this
right.
substance, this preservative substance on the back gate or on the sock supposedly in the bedroom, how did it get there? I mean, you've got to have an explanation for that. Why is the blood on the socks in the bedroom? First of all, the socks aren't there at 4:13 per video from Willie Ford, but they're there 20 minutes later. How did you get on those socks? Why is the blood there put there by compression? Why does the blood go from side one to side two to side three if there's a leg in it? There are things in this case that any rational person, if you understand the facts, will never be able to explain.
But as a former prosecutor,
yes.
Aren't there always things you can't explain in a criminal case because of what different people see and what happens to evidence always?
can't explain. Why do the photographs of the back fence taken around June 12th and 13th, they don't show any blood back there.
But the fact that Bannetta kept that vial of blood,
yes,
and does not prove that he tampered with it.
No,
the fact that he kept it and didn't immediately go do something with it does not prove that he had criminal intent.
But it gives him the opportunity. You see,
got to do is show opportunity to create doubt.
And then you'd be like, yes, exactly.
And that's
more
what it's about.
No, more than that.
Create doubt and you're on your way.
Well, more than that. You have to have the opportunity, first of all. If they're going to get taken the blood, then you might be hard-pressed to do it. But you have the blood as EDTA. And, of course, now you find...
That's two things.
Okay, so you have the blood as EDTA in that blood, and now you find EDTA on several of the items.
Well,
you know, does it take a rocket scientist to figure that? That is certainly a reasonable hypothesis for what happened. And you couple that with...
It takes a jury,
that, because of their life experience... might find that reasonable.
That's right. We talk about
that's reasonable.
That's when you get it on it better than almost anyone else. It is about the history of this department. If you live in Los Angeles, you understand. This may not be how it is in Des Moines, Iowa. You may even have two parking areas. If you grew up in L.A. and there's a oral tradition that's passed down many times through women in the community, customers will understand this. You don't have to tell anybody about that.
Did any part of Johnny Cochran say, because of all this history that I outlined in the first 15 minutes of this conversation, say, I want to win this case because of O.J. Simpson. I believe he's innocent, but also I want to put it to the L.A. Police Department in a case where they believe and think they've got their man, and I want to put him, take their measure in the most highly publicized suit in the history of American jurisprudence.
No.
Not anything to say, I'm going to show you, get you, prove to you that this no longer will happen in Los Angeles because I'm going to show what.
No, I believe he was innocent, the first part. I believe he was innocent. I believe that. But let me tell you why that wasn't so. The guy was so. Because you think about it logically, I was the one who should have cross-examined from Bob's Pearl asked me to do it.
You didn't want to do that.
But I didn't want to do it because it escalated the nation's attention. And I opted it.
Well, I figured it out. You didn't have to come on for it.
I got old grit.
I know, but this guy, you so what?
No, I'm the one that's doing it. I'm the one that got the tapes. I had the stomach for it. That's what I had done.
But you didn't do it. Why?
I didn't do it because I didn't want to escalate the racial tensions. I thought that if you saw this black lawyer out there asking this white police officer these questions, everybody expected that. It would certainly play into racial feelings. And I live in Los Angeles. Twice in my career as a lawyer, I've seen my city go up in smoke. And I didn't want to do it.
I was Johnny Cochran. I was that good. I would have had a hard time when I came to the part that was later used, in a sense, to indict Johnny Cochran about comparing the LAPD and Hitler because of what you knew. Not the question of what was in your heart, but the fact that, as smart as you are, the potential for the feelings it would create. Because the Holocaust to all of society, and especially Jews in the world, has never been anything or will ever be anything so evil.
You know, I'm not going to get into comparing tragedies. No, I'm not going to talk about slavery.
That was really received.
I understand that. Let me tell you, one of the things that happened during my closing argument, I would not use that phrase or that analogy. Well, let me tell you a little bit about that.
You would not use it on second.
No, I would not. I would not use it because I think it was misunderstood. That came from a Jewish lawyer who came directly, who lost much of his family in Auschwitz, Chuck Lindner. He writes also for the LA Times. That was an analogy that he proposed. The reason was, we knew that Furman was a Nazi member, a collecting person, and very possibly a person who had Nazi ties. That's what everybody said. We've been in this room and knew this. The prosecutors also knew that. It seemed like an apt description. All I was trying to say, and I said, Furman didn't have the power of Hitler, who was a scourge. I didn't minimize the showing of the Holocaust at all. What I was trying to say was that Sir Edmund Burke said it better. All that's required for evil to thrive is for good men to remain silent. So I was trying to say, and I might have said that better and easier.
That would have been a much better way to put it.
People were so emotional, and so I would not do that again. But that's what I was trying to say. I have been to Israel. I have been to Yad Vashem. I understand about the Holocaust. I'm an African-American. I know about it. You didn't get
the civil rights movement over here. Black Americans had no better friends than Jewish Americans.
And I have no better friends than Jewish Americans now. And so I would not have done that, but I think it was misunderstood. I really do, John.
Anything else you wouldn't have done in that trial?
I think there's
regrets.
I think that's probably the major regret. I think the other things, you know, and as I said, I don't think that that was an appropriate analogy coming from a Jewish lawyer.
Yeah.
But because of the misunderstanding, it just wasn't, I wouldn't do that again. The other things, I was an advocate. It wasn't about trying to take the popular course, Charlie. It was about trying to represent the client.
Did it make any difference to you whether Simpson did it or not?
Yes, it did, and it would. Because let me tell you why. I would never support perjury. I would
not.
I understand.
You can't do that.
You can't do that.
Yes, perjury. But so far, you, Simpson, could say, well, I didn't do it. And you take his word for it.
Yeah, Charlie, you got to take the clients at their word.
But you didn't put him on the trial, so you're not suborning perjury.
Right, but I mean, but if you tried to introduce evidence of the timeline, if you said, look, I did this, you wouldn't even call any witnesses to try and show that you did it. You couldn't do that, you know. You would, but in this case, he did testify, as you're aware. But he always maintained he didn't do it. He never did believe in that with any of us.
I understand that, and everybody I talked to, Barashek's been on the show for an hour as well, and he said the same thing. He said, I believed in the guy.
Yeah.
And then they say, well, why do you believe in him? I mean, Ullman. So why do you believe in the guy? Well, it's just the way he was suggested to me.
That's true.
How can you, you know, to say, ask you these questions, suggested that you believe that Simpson lied, you believe that he did it and all that. But how can you know that somebody didn't do it because of the way they look and the way they talk?
No, you can't. You can't know that. But what you do is you try to, you take the,
and because they take his word for it.
You take the word for it, but also.
But I would argue that anybody would kill would lie.
No. That may be true, but you also look at it and say, what this person tells you, and if it checks out, he says to you certain things that he check out.
Did you have to know for yourself then? Did you have to go check it out and know for yourself before you would say yes?
No, from the standpoint, I knew O.J. Simpson. From the very beginning, he said yes.
Because I knew O.J. Simpson, I said, I'll do it, I'll take your word for it, I'm not going to go check it out, where with most people, you would want to check it out.
No, I wouldn't. Most people don't really have the luxury of going out to, you're not like the basket, you don't go out and check everything out. Now, somewhere along the way, in the course of the case, you may change your mind. I think this guy's not telling the truth.
But did you ever have a moment like that in what you said?
No, we didn't. I did not.
The memory's faulty here in terms of what he said, because it's not for the public record.
No,
it's not
no.
For the jury. And what you say, we've got a contradiction here. How do we figure out how to do something about this contradiction?
No, he would always be able to explain things. And you know, one of the things that really helped us a lot was the interview we had with the police. Those 30 minutes on tape.
Yeah.
And at the very beginning. And, you know, that said a lot, because then he had, what, 1 or 2 hours of sleep.
Right.
He came back talking to some detectives. His lawyer said, you shouldn't do this. He said, I'm out.
Just Howard Weissman?
Yeah, Howard Weissman and Skip Tech. They left and left him alone with these officers. He was in a car riding with them downtown.
Now, why would they do that?
Because according to Howard Weissman and the others, the letter in the morning said, if you insist on being the only one of your client. Somebody said, look, I have nothing that I want to talk with him.
Yeah. I mean, promise me, if I'm ever brought, I hire you and I'm brought before the police. You know, and the police officer said, I'll listen to you, and I don't go talk to the police. I mean, that's stupid. Hey, it's stupid.
It's not the one.
I mean, that was stupid. My wife can point to it.
Well,
so you allow your client and your friend, in this case, I guess?
Well, you know, I always felt that if your client insists on doing it, you either one or two things. You drag him out of there, or you say,
you drag yourself out of the case.
That's it.
One or the other.
I'm leaving the case. That's exactly it.
Is that why Weissman left? Or did he leave the case?
No.
The reason, you know, the speculation in Los Angeles.
No, I mean, at that point, he's still on the case. No, I mean, leave right at that moment.
You're right. If you do this, you got another lawyer.
Right.
Because you're hurting yourself, and
that's
I'm not really part of you engaging in suicide.
That's exactly correct.
There are two other books I want to talk to you about. One is Vincent Bullios. He says, it was a winnable case for the prosecution, and they blew it.
I read that book. I knew that
you were alive.
That's right. I tried the case in over 20 years. From what it seems to me, it's like a press release of nothing new. How did he never even came to court? So he didn't watch the case. For
I know what else he said, though, which I didn't know he says that. I haven't read this book. He hasn't read any of these books except this one. This is a story of you. This is more than
not
a story of the trial. And that's why I went through it the way I did, to say, who is Johnny Cochran before we figure out where is it? How does he come to be here before we examine what he did once he was there? Bugliosi seems to say that the LAPD just to question him for 45 minutes, that was stupid. You know, know, I've talked to other people who in law enforcement say, if I'd had that opportunity, he would have been there a lot longer than 45 minutes, and maybe 6 hours would have been better.
You know what, though, Charlie, all of these things,
if you were a prosecutor and you'd had an opportunity to do that, you would have been thrilled by that opportunity.
Oh, absolutely.
Wouldn't you?
Certainly wouldn't
be. 6 hours, I mean, to go at the guy and you let him go for 45 minutes, if, in fact, there's some reason to believe he might have done.
He's in there without,
exactly,
without a lawyer even. I mean, understand that.
How stupid is that?
Well, these two detectives had been there.
So maybe these guys are not.
27 years apiece, basically. And if he didn't, so we will see. Here's what he does. Listen, Edward, he only toots his own horn. He's saying, it's easy when you're standing on the sideline to say, I could have done this, could have, would have, should have. You know, that's just make believe in his own mind. He hasn't had a case in 20 years. He's an author. He needs to stay there and stop speculating about real lawyers who are actually trying cases. Those of us who are out here, we'd have been glad to have Vincent Liosi. Time has passed.
You could have taken Liosi on this case.
It would have been no contest. Marcia Clark is a tough lawyer. She's been trying cases. She's real. She's out there. I know what you thought about what he did 20 years ago. The Manson case, and I'm not taking anything away from that case, but I mean, most people could have known the Manson case. You have a defendant that had a slap skin in his forehead, threatened to kill the jury, and that was an example.
All kinds of blood evidence everywhere.
That was not a tough case to win. So, you know, he should stop riding that horse and stay out of this. He's not one who really should be commenting. I mean, the other participants, I can understand the way he's writing. He didn't watch the trial or whatever. He just comes and tells us he could win. It was an outrage otherwise.
And you say you would have loved to have
him. We would have loved to have him try this case. We would have loved to have him into a person we were, because emotionally, we would have loved to. I've seen Vincent. I've been on the program with him. I've seen his reaction to various things. We all loved it. And there's no question about that. So I don't put much stock. I mean, that's just what he's talking about is speculation. He wasn't even there. But what he tries to do is he turns it around, though, and criticizes everybody. And what he does in that process is build himself up. He says, if I'd been there, unlike Darden, who he said was incompetent, and Clark, and the officers, he would have done everything right. Now, that's really easy to talk about.
He says the prosecutor was incompetent, too.
And he was there.
And he also is a lawyer.
Tubin was there, and he's a lawyer. And I was going to say about Jeffrey Tubin. Jeffrey Tubin, though, you know, he's an engaging young man. And when he and I talked during the trial, I'll tell you something interesting about him. He was very biased, and he would admit it. He made a decision early on that he thought O.J. Simpson was guilty, and it colored everything he did. Quick example. One day, he was on the Today Show in the morning, and he came on the air and told the national television audience, today the prosecution is going to show that a photograph of a glove of Simpson taken as an announcer has a defect in it, and that defect will match the glove in court. And I suddenly went there and said, Jeffrey, why do you do things like that? Did you just make that up? Well, somebody told me that. That's typical of the kind of thing that he would do. Well, I don't know if anybody told him that or not, but there was absolutely no truth in that. And he had an obligation to look out these things. I mean, he should call me up and ask me, did you ever tell anybody that you thought such a thing? You never did that. And we know each other. He wouldn't do that. So if he was looking for some source or somebody to tell you something, that's one thing. And, you know, he is a talented fellow. But he was just dead wrong on a number of issues. Simpson didn't know about the verdict they made before.
That's the other point. Somebody in the jail and staff told him that they had a friend who had a friend. And one of the, I guess, alternative jurors, that's the story, one of the alternative jurors told somebody.
Somebody asked for Simpson's autograph, which is the process.
Yeah, because we know you get that hanging tomorrow, so we want to get the autograph now. Simpson did not know.
No, he did not know.
But you also say Shapiro turned to Simpson and said, be ready for this, they're going to convict you.
Absolutely. When Judge Neal looked down toward the center of the courtroom after he saw the verdict, he had this look on his face. Shapiro leaned over and said, it's going to be bad news. You're going to get convicted. I said, Bob, you knock it off.
Shut up.
He called Dershowitz the night before and said, get the appeal ready. That was the same night I had gone out and had this interview with Barbara Walters, too. So he had a different theory. His theory was he would come in, forget your amnesia, blame us for the race card, claim if he'd been in charge, he would have worked out fine, we lost the case. None of that worked for him.
Race card from the bottom of the deck.
And you can imagine he's the one who brought it up.
Okay, but before that, you were sitting watching ABC with Barbara Walters and Shapiro that night.
I didn't see that.
Heard about it. Would you think, would you want to pick up the phone and call him, and did you?
No.
You didn't call him? You didn't bring it up with him? You never spoke to him since?
I haven't spoken to him since, because I haven't seen him since October 3rd.
So what happens if he calls you up and says, Johnny, let's have lunch and figure out what separates us?
I would do that.
You would?
I would do that, because of the fact that, you know, we had a relationship in this case, and he does some things that I would love to hear his explanation for. I think he could not explain it.
Like what?
The shifting sands, getting this interview, turning on his teammates. I mean, the last 3 months or so working on his book, taping our conversation, going down and seeing O.J. Simpson. I told O.J. Simpson about the tape. tape recorder. He said, I'm not surprised. He said, because he came down to see me at the jail and took his tape recorder out and said, tell me your animal's thoughts. And, you know, so
not the way you get somebody to tell animal's thoughts anyway.
Yes.
Emily Bailey.
A fine lawyer, and I have a lot of respect for him. He did an excellent job on Furman, especially. That was, I thought, the high point of this trial. And he never got the plaudits he deserved. His cross-examination was so excellent that when we found those tapes, it fit right with
the 10 years. So he used 10 years. He didn't know about the tape.
No, he didn't know about those tapes at all.
A bad time for you is when you got two of your guys duking it out in public.
Some people say, if you talk to Barry Schick and Jerry Oldman, they said that perhaps the greatest achievement we had was keeping the team together where 2 minutes don't even talk. They didn't want to ride in the same car together. And they had been close where Lou Bailey was Shapiro and Sharon Son's godfather.
Well, not only that, Shapiro had defended Bailey, had you?
Yeah, defended him. They were very close. They're on each other's letterhead. It's over the top. So we managed to do that also because it's about the kind, not our personal egos or our personal problems.
And this is whenever you interview a criminal defense lawyer, and somebody watches the interview, they come to you and say, I just want to know one thing.
<Very good.
laughs> What is it? Tell me what you think it is.
Would you defend someone if you thought
he was guilty? That's what they always say.
Yeah, well, I know that. That's why I know that.
Yeah.
And it depends. If a client comes to me and says, I'm guilty, will you defend me? I said, well, you want me to go down and work this case out, get into some kind of a plea bargain? Then fine, I can do that. If the client says, no, I want you to give me a fill out all defense and cross examine all the witnesses, I probably wouldn't take it, but certainly would be ethically and morally okay if you did it, as long as the guy said you did it, and as long as you didn't try to blame the witnesses when you knew they would be lying. You could cross examine the witnesses clearly. That seemed to be a tougher situation. The interesting part of that is hardly any client ever tells any lawyer that unless he wants to plead guilty.
It's like they say in prison. Everybody here, buddy, is innocent. It's afraid. Every one of them.
Yeah.
Nobody, not few of them there, would say, I belong to be here. What happens now? First of all, if something happens and somehow, for some reason, some piece of evidence turns up, or O.J. Simpson says, I can't take it, in fact, I have, notwithstanding Johnny Cochran, notwithstanding Barry Schick, and notwithstanding Peter Newfield, and notwithstanding all those people who fought valiantly to save my life.
Yes.
I lied to them.
We'd be terribly, I can speak myself, and I know Barry would too. We'd be terribly disappointed. We did our jobs based upon everything that we knew at the time, all the evidence and whatever, based upon relying on our client. I don't think this would ever happen, but we'd be really disappointed if it did.
And you have no reason in your mind. Nothing's ever caused you to say. Lawrence Schiller, you know him?
Yes, I know him very sure.
He's got a book too.
Yes, apparently so. That's the Kardashian.
Yeah, that's right. That's the Kardashian. Well, I mean, there's some other things in there. He seems to believe. How do all these guys come to these conclusions? Tubman seems to believe. Nick Dunn seems to believe. How do all these people sit around and watch this trial in the courtroom? Is it because their experience was different from the jurors? Is that the reason so many reporters seem to cover this trial and believe this guy?
Okay.
Tubman believes it. Nick Dunn believes it.
Well, let's take the first.
Schiller knows Simpson. I don't know what I've read his book either, but
Let me take the first two. Schiller, I have not read his book.
I mean, I don't know.
But the first two. Dominic Dunn said at the very beginning, too, that I have more respect for Dominic Dunn than others, because he said he lost the trial.
He said,
like, I can't be fair. Yeah, I think this guy's guilty. He said that. So all of everything he did was colored by that. But he said nothing terribly to say that. Tubman is a lawyer and should know better. So I don't forgive him as easily for doing that. Larry Schiller, I don't know. Larry Schiller wrote the first book and bestseller, I Want to Tell You, O.J. Simpson, and had his confidence and made money off O.J. Simpson. Now, I don't know until somebody tells me otherwise that he says O.J. Simpson.
I don't know
I'd be really surprised
if that happened. Yeah, but he's got Kardashian and,
Well, this tease.
Yeah. All right, let me ask you, how has this changed your life?
Oh, it's because I have a lot less privacy when you come into a building like
this. You write a book for $4.5 million for this thing?
Well, I can't talk about the
But you got more than anybody else. You take some pride in that, don't you?
You got more than
Chris Stern.
I take pride in that book. I really do now. And it's not just a Simpson book. So fortunately,
well, I pointed that out.
And you've been really good about that. But yeah, I take some pride in the fact that you have this book that I got a chance to write it. And I hope it talks about the justice system.
I want to come to that in just a moment in terms of legacy of all this.
Sure. Are you happy about Chris Darden's success?
I am. I'm happy for his success. And you know, I wish him well. I said in the book, I wish him well, but I also wish him some wisdom. This idea of attacking the jury, going around crying, acting like a whining crying, that's not professional. And you know, stop it. One of the best things I did for Chris Darden, I took him aside as a person that I care about, and I said, don't you take Furman. Who's going to take him as a witness? So that's the advice he got during that trial.
Now, why should Chris Darden trust you?
He didn't take it.
When you're the lead defense attorney.
Because I looked in the mirror and I told him, I said, don't you take this guy. This guy's a bad guy.
What did he say to you about Marsha Clark?
Oh, he said, okay. He said, it's like a leave my woman alone. You get all upset about it. You know, I was just like, I said, what are you talking about your woman? What do you mean by that? I presume he's jesting about it. But you know, you never know.
You never know.
You never know.
A lot of people think that this shows the ugly, ugly, ugly face of racism in the reaction to this trial. African-Americans split Americans on this. And it says race remains the American dilemma.
It does. I think race is the American dilemma. And I think the problem is the cure proposed is one of denial by so many Americans. Denial will not cure it. We've got to.
Denial is that a jury had an opportunity for that knowledge.
Now, denial about the issue of race. People don't want to talk about race in this country. It's a hard subject. It's a taboo. Don't ask, don't tell. That's how we don't solve it. You don't put it on the table. We need to get it out front and talk about the things that separate us. There are far more things, Charlie, that unite us than those that separate us. I agree. That's what I believe.
Talk to the president about this.
President
on the
Clinton.
Phone, President Clinton.
No, I have not, and I would love to, because I think we need moral leadership at the highest level in this regard. So I'm going to say, W.E.B. Du Bois said at the beginning.
Is what you put in the last
page. When I talk about the two disasters,
right.
The problem of the 20th century could be the problem of the color.
Right.
He's absolutely right. The only problem is going to be the problem of the 21st century, unless somebody steps up and says, wait a minute, the road traveled by blacks and whites together has brought us closer in a union, and somebody has to bring us together. This is our country, we love it, all of us.
But knowing that, it must bother you a little bit that when they think of Johnny Cochran's defense of O.J. Simpson, they say he played the race card. He used race.
Yes, and it probably bothers me because that's wrong, as I hope we've demonstrated tonight. Not only is it wrong, I never brought it up. I dealt with the witnesses, and I dealt with credibility in the history of the LAPD. I didn't use race any more than I used in the other case. If I had not gone after this particular witness, Furman, it would have been malpractice. It's just that simple. Ask any lawyer.
What do you think about what Furman is saying now? You know what he's saying? He's saying, I'm sorry.
Yeah. That would be fine if he didn't turn right around and try to blame the jury, saying that they made him a scapegoat. He's no scapegoat.
That's what he said. What he said is that he made it easy for them to scapegoat him or whatever. No, he said, the fact that I was there as a liar made it easier for them to convict Simpson.
Not to acquit Simpson.
Right.
I think the apology we can accept, but he's in massive denial as to who he is and what this jury did. The jury didn't like him from the beginning, and he had nothing to do. They weren't really interested in him being a scapegoat. He should just come in there and told the truth. That's what we're talking about. And what kind of message is this in? A police officer gets on the pen and lies, and the first 20-minute case, he gets a $200 fine, he has to go home to Idaho.
What would have been appropriate from Johnny Cochran?
Some time in custody. Absolutely. But any other person would have gotten under circumstances. What kind of message do you send to police officers? Is it okay to lie? You got $200 fine?
Well, give me a nice sentence that you think would be appropriate.
Well, the sentence carries up to 3 years. I leave that to the judge, but I think you should have gone to prison.
Absolutely.
Perjury in a murder case like this? Absolutely. He said himself, I'm the key witness in the trial of the century. I go down, the blood goes out, the case goes bye-bye, and he should have gone bye-bye for lying.
What about you accused police officers lying too? Should they go to prison?
Well, another police officer from
no others. You accuse
no, no,
and
I mean,
that outline.
Well, if they no, I think in that situation, then in this situation, you know, talk about the you don't found he had a reckless disregard for the truth. You're using it there. And I think in a situation like that, I don't think
you're talking. Aren't you accusing the line when you say something happened to the vial and then they did something with it? Well, I mean, he's the one that had custody of it. If you're saying that something was done to it, you're saying he did it.
What I really said about that was the fact that I couldn't explain why he had his blood, and I thought that certainly opens up to all kinds of possibilities. But I also said the Fiato brothers impeached him because he told them that he went over there,
right,
that the husband's always a suspect now.
Right.
Is that impeachment or not? You know, there's an impeachment. And it's like, I've never used this N-word in 10 years. That's the difference.
Johnny L. Cochran, proud son of Johnny L. Cochran Sr., who tonight, the Plaza Hotel, at a book party, will be there with his son. Author, defense attorney, American. Journey to Justice is book. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry.
My pleasure. Pleasure.
Okay, pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. See you tomorrow.
Well, you just had an opportunity to hear a presentation by the former defense attorney, leading defense attorney for the O.J. Simpson trial. However, if you listen very carefully, Charlie Rose was the actually host for the show and asked some very sound questions about that whole thing called the trial of O.J. Simpson. And it turned out to be a very huge eye-opener for me listening to this particular presentation. Now, for example, Johnny Cochran didn't live that much longer after that. He died of a cerebral hemorrhage, a brain tumor that they said was located all of a sudden in his head. Here's a man who spent a lot of time getting black people off from different kinds of situations that the court felt it necessary to try them on. I wonder if he were alive, would he have had an opportunity to help Bill Cosby? Because he had that kind of mind that would allow for the truth to surface. In any event, his death to me doesn't ring too well. It doesn't smell right. Mainly because when you think of Martin Luther King being shot and then him not dying but from the shot, but being smothered to death, which has come out not so long ago about him dying from somebody smothering him when they had him in the hospital and were working on him. Somebody smothered him to death. My goodness, this is after the operation? That was one thing. And then you know about the killings of Malcolm X, and we could just go through a whole litany of people that we've had who have died trying to bring some clear justice in the concept of race. I mean, I don't know if it was called a concept, but in the idea of what we've all experienced in race, how they treated Muhammad Ali, how Joe Louis was treated with taxes. I mean, just one situation right after the next. So let me tell you, this has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean, and you've had the opportunity to hear Johnny Cochran, who's no longer with us, being interviewed by Charlie Rose on the O.J. Simpson trial. Hopefully you'll have an opportunity to once again listen to us this coming Friday at 4:30. The show will be aired, and we will have another situation that will be posing a lot of different kinds of questions. And until then, have a good day, and hopefully the good Lord will smile in your direction.